Morning, everybody. Welcome to the second round of the Members Weekend talks. We have two talks this morning. After that, we have another panel discussion, and then we finish the weekend with a lunch. And I would like to introduce now the first speaker of today, Bob Stone. You know, he's our president. He's our chairman. Sorry, our chairman. And he, I think, got hooked to philosophy in 2009. So he has some background. He's an expert in Greek philosophy and can fluently translate Aristotle, I think. So please, Bob, it's your turn.
Right, good morning. Presumably you can hear me, can you? Either mic or good. Now, the myth of rationality. Now, rationality in the sense of reasoning is a very important concept to philosophers. Plato thinks that intelligent reasoning gives us all the answers to everything. Kant claims that no one does anything genuinely moral unless she does it because her reason tells her that it is the one moral choice. And yet there's also a tradition of skepticism about our ability to reason. Plato wants to restrict political power to the handful of men and women who alone are governed by their reason rather than by some lower mental capacity, which just happens to be philosophers like him. Mm-hmm. And Kant is so pessimistic about the prospect of anyone being able to listen to his reason rather than to other inclinations that he places reason outside the perceptible world of natural cause and effect and locates it in the transcendent world of things in themselves. Paul Bertrand Russell complained that, I wouldn't do the accent but I did, it has been said that man is a rational animal. All my life I've been searching for evidence which could support this. Now, I don't think that these pessimistic philosophers are worried about people's IQ. What they've noticed is what we all notice about other people. Even the cleverest of them do stupid things and think stupid thoughts. It is as though our minds are overwhelmed by inclinations other than the desire to reason clearly, and so any ability we may have to reason is negated by all that baggage. Now, what I aim to do in this talk, which of course will be an entirely rational exception to that general rule, is first to show how what we think is rational thinking is often nothing of the sort, and second, to look closely at what remains, what seems like genuine reasoning, and show that insofar as it has any real worth, it is not really what we mean by reasoning at all. Now, some of you will have read the recent book by Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow, which gives the conclusions of a massive research carried out over the last few decades into the way people think. It has the merit of being very clear, very thorough, and very entertaining, though that last point, according to its own thesis, is a good reason to be especially careful when judging its content. Now, most of the research is in the form of administering tests, usually questions, to large numbers of people, often students at American universities, and so, we presume, moderately intelligent. The tests can be, and often have been, easily replicated by other psychologists, who are only too keen to show up methodological failings. And so there are some controversies, at least, about the implications of some results. But the general findings seem pretty well established. And furthermore, when you read about them, you quickly recognise your own limitations, or at least those of others. Now, Kahneman distinguishes two systems in our way of thinking, which he calls System 1 and System 2. He does stress that these are not meant to be literal, a literal description of two parts of the brain or mind. just a device for distinguishing two different ways in which we think. System two is the rational one, which thinks clearly and logically, and for that reason often slowly. It's system one that is dominant, even when we believe we're thinking rationally. The result is that we tend to believe things not because there is some reason to suppose that they are true, but because of certain cognitive biases. Here are a few examples. We accept an idea because it's familiar to us, or it is presented to us in a nice way, or it fits what we already believe. We're also happy to jump to conclusions on the basis of minimal evidence, as if what you see is all there is, those initials there. We're influenced by words or pictures we see just before we are told something, whether by accident or placed there by someone trying to influence us, including things we don't even know we've seen, as in subliminal advertising. If a small number has just come up on a roulette table, you will be likely to make a lower estimate of some totally unrelated fact, like the price of a bottle of champagne, than if it had been a high number. And we're particularly hopeless in dealing with statistics, and I want to dwell on one example to illustrate. I'll just read this, as you're going to be reading it anyway. Linda is 31 years old, single, outspoken, very bright. She majored in philosophy. As a student, she was deeply concerned with issues of discrimination and social justice, and also participated in anti-nuclear demonstrations. Right, that's the fact you're told. And then people are asked to rank these scenarios in order of probability. Now, the only two I'm interested in here are F and H. Nearly all in these tests ranked H above F. And even when only those two alternatives were presented to groups of students in several universities in America, between 85 and 90% put H above F. Now, I don't have to explain to a PhilSoc audience that regardless of what qualities Linda has, it is simply more likely that she, or anyone at all, is a bank teller than that she is a bank teller with feminist tendencies. The latter category is a subcategory of the former, and therefore smaller. Now, just to check that this wasn't a cognitive flaw prevalent only in the young, I gave this test, or an equivalent one, to various people nearer my age that I've met in the last few months. The result is the same. Nearly everybody puts H above F. They all saw the point immediately when I explained it and felt rather sheepish. And I had to admit that I'd made the same mistake when I first read the Linda problem. But they still hated me. Now, there's some dispute about the implications of such tests. I suspect that when people read bank teller, along with bank teller active in the feminist movement, they imagine the mere bank teller as one who is not active in the feminist movement, even though that's not what it says. So they are comparing a non-feminist bank teller with a feminist bank teller. They do not consciously think to themselves, bank teller means bank teller who is not active in the feminist movement, but it forms part of their thinking. And that is a crucial aspect of thinking. Much of what is included in the process is not consciously present. In the case of subliminal suggestions, we don't ever know that they are, at least until someone tells us. In the case of tests like these, we realize afterwards that we must have been thinking something unconsciously, but were not aware at the time. Now, the great mass of psychological evidence amassed by Kahneman demonstrates that the intuition that shapes most of our thinking, though essential for getting through life without getting bogged down every few seconds by systematic reasoning, and is generally right, is full of cognitive biases which make much of it plain mind. In a way, this is not surprising. When I engage in thinking, I'm not using some special faculty of the mind, or switching on some dedicated rational neurons in the brain. When philosophers discuss the nature of the self, in other words, the nature of me or I, it is always assumed that whatever it is something unified, or at least something that gives us the illusion of being unified. It is the same I that sees, hears, feels, thinks, remembers, and the same I as the one that saw, heard, felt, thought, and remembered yesterday, or 10 years ago. The I that engages in thinking at a particular moment is the I that I have become over a number of decades, with all kinds of ingrained attitudes, memories, tastes, feelings that are a background to any experience I have whatsoever, not to mention more temporary accompaniments such as mood, tension, discomfort in the leg, and what I've just heard or seen. So if I do have to do some simple piece of reasoning, such as multiplying 15 by 17 in my head, there will be a context in which I'm doing it. Maybe somebody's asked me, what is 15 by 17? My reaction to the question may be a desire to help someone I like, or irritation that I have to take my mind off the television, or suspicion that the inquirer is testing me. Now I contend that it's simply impossible to have nothing in my mind except the process of reasoning. Now in the case of something fairly simple like multiplication, it is unlikely that any of those things will affect the answer, although they may slow me down or speed me up or possibly lead me to think too quickly and make a silly mistake. How much more susceptible to distortion by our acquired personality and surrounding feelings is a more complicated piece of reasoning, especially where practical judgment is involved rather than merely following mathematical or logical rules. We've all noticed that just about everybody in the world, except ourselves, holds more or less exactly the same beliefs about important matters as their parents, or if not their parents, the kind of people among whom they live. If someone is asked why he holds that belief, he does not usually say, because my parents brought me up to believe it, but gives some kind of rationale. It's hard to avoid the conclusion that almost all reasons given by people to justify beliefs about anything important are not the actual reason for, in the sense of the cause of, the beliefs being held. They are thought up in order to justify a belief that is going to be held regardless of the relevant evidence and reasons. Not quite all reasons, however. Each one of us in our own minds is an exception to that rule. Now, some might think that I'm exaggerating. Perish the thought. You may agree that an awful lot of people, an awful lot of what people believe to be rational thought is in fact not rational at all, but hopelessly skewed by forms of cognitive bias. Such as wishful thinking, laziness, love of the familiar, loyalty to one's earlier beliefs, loyalty to the beliefs of the family or community. But at the end of the day, you still believe that it is possible to transcend, in a not necessarily Kantian sense, all those anti-rational influences and to think rationally according to Kahneman's system too. Now, to express the contrast in a different way, Tim Bain, a professor of psychology who wrote the OUP Very Short Guide to Thought, mentioned yesterday, he wrote in The New Scientist, which happens to be published a year ago today, that there are two types of train of thought. The associative one, where one thought leads naturally to another, like a game of word association. And the systematic variety, which uses evidence and logic. Now, I'm going to argue that the distinction is illusory, and that the apparently systematic type of thought is merely a subset of the associative one. So let us see what actually happens in the systematic kind of thinking. You are set a problem to solve by sheer thinking. The first thing to note is that different people, even those who come up with the same answer, have quite different things going on in their minds. Some may talk to themselves out loud. Others may have their minds full of pictures or images of words or imagined sounds of words. Different things will occur to them at different times, such as earlier problems about Linda the bank teller, which warned them against certain ideas. Or for that matter, quite extraneous memories of something associated with a word or name in the problem. Some might think systematically along a certain route. Others might keep being sidetracked by memories and ideas from their experience, including ideas that make the solution suddenly easier, but which don't occur to the more single-minded. How do we judge whether you are thinking rationally or not? Simply by the result that you give at the end of it. If you wanted to convince others that you had thought rationally, you would not try to reconstruct all the things that flitted through your mind. You would explain how the answer you've given is a correct answer to the question. It is the analysis of the outcome of the thinking, as expressed in words or other symbols, that decides whether the thinking that produced it, and indeed the thinker, are to be called rational. Let us look at three types of problem solving. First, a simple problem of arithmetic or logic, which has one right answer, 7 times 2. Now, like most people, I simply remember from learning it years ago that the answer is 14. No reasoning needed there. So let's take a more complicated 7 times 15. The tables I learned at school only went up to 12, so I don't have an automatic remembered response to the question. So what do I do? Well, I do remember, because it immediately occurs to me, that to multiply 7 by 15, you can multiply 7 by 10, which is easy, and 7 by 5, which is easy, and add the two results together. Now, 7 by 10 is an automatic 70, learned it at school. 7 by 5, the same, 35. So I need to add 70 and 35. No automatic response, perhaps, but again, I can do it in steps. First, add 30 to 70. Easy, I just know it, 100. And then add 5 to 100, which is obviously 105. Now, that entire operation consists of memories, whether of learned facts or of learned methods, each prompted by the one before in the way that I've been trained. Now, another problem of the same sort is one which I remember hearing from Peter Milligan in this very room a couple of years ago. There's a medical condition which one person in a million has. A man goes to see the doctor and asks if he has it. The doctor gives him a test which he says is 99% reliable. In other words, it gives the right answer on 99% of occasions. The test is positive. It says the man has the condition. How worried should he be? Now again, I followed the inexorable logic. If the test is 99% likely to be right and it says the man has the condition, then the man is 99% likely to have the condition. My thinking was as systematic as you can get, pure logic, pure rationality. Except, now as you all know, it's completely wrong. Peter Milligan explained the true logic of the situation and showed that the man's chances of having the condition have in fact risen from 1 in 1 million to about 1 in 10,000, not 99 out of 100. From now on, when given a similar problem, I shall remember the method and quite likely get it right. It's all a matter of having learnt and being prompted by the situation to remember the correct steps to take. Whether I get the answer to such questions right or wrong depends entirely on whether I have learnt the correct facts and procedures, and whether, if I have learnt them, they occur to me when prompted. Now, my second type of problem, you can do it while you're listening to me if you like, fine. But is this Times polygon puzzle on the 26th of August. This is one where I don't have the time or inclination to go through all the steps necessary to work it out systematically. You have to make as many words as you can from the letters in that polygon, and there is always at least one familiar word which consists of all the letters. Now, there are 7 letters there, and you probably know the counterintuitive fact that there are 5,040 different orders in which they can be put. Only one of those orders is a proper word. How do you set about finding it? Now, if you're a system obsessive, or a computer, you could run through all 5,040 combinations, matching each against your dictionary, until you come to a real word. That would take me all day. And a computer, in fact, could do it in less than a second, as I checked on a program called Andy's Anagrams. I, being a mere human being, just look at the letters, moving them around a bit in my imagination, and spot the answer. In this case, it took me about 2 seconds, although on other days, an equally familiar word may take me 10 minutes to spot. The result of my unsystematic staring is entirely rational. The word unscrew, I've given it to you if you haven't got it, the word unscrew is the only English word, at least of the 209,000 in the Andes Anagrams Dictionary, which is an anagram of those letters. Now, how does my brain do it? Well, I have no idea. But it's not systematic rational analysis. It's a kind of inspiration or intuition, call it what you will, or some word like that, which produces an answer which I can then check against the letters to make sure it works. Sometimes my intuition comes up with the wrong answer at first, as I realise when I check the letters off, and so I have another stare. It's not sheer randomness. When I saw those letters, I immediately noticed that the word might start un, common English prefix, and then I spotted unscrew straight away. And the fact that I have more than 50 years' experience of doing crosswords must be a factor in my success. But the process is one of seeing what occurs to me and then checking it to see if it works. And if you get bored, can you spot the 11-letter surname of a composer that makes those letters, Red Chipmunk? There are almost 40 million combinations of those letters, and only one of them is a real word, and that's the name of this composer. Now, my third type of problem is a much more interesting and difficult kind, where there's no one right answer waiting to be worked out. For example, what does it mean to have a soul? Or how can we bring peace to the Middle East? I'm going to use a rather more manageable example, as I've only got 30 minutes. Let us suppose when I arrive at school tomorrow, one of my 4 lessons a week, the headmaster asks me to solve a problem that no one has yet managed. There are 40 periods a week on the timetable, but the total number of lessons that pupil in the fifth form, which is, I think, year 11 in government speak, absolutely must have, amounts to 43. Sort it, Stone, he says. Now, quite apart from all the irrelevant feelings that are likely to occur to me, like desire to impress a brand new head, irritation when I thought I'd left this kind of stuff behind when I retired from full-time teaching, all kinds of relevant idea might occur to me, or to anyone else, differing according to our experience and temperament. Some of these are facts about the school I think I know, and facts that I don't know won't occur to me. Some are bright ideas, e.g. abolish games lessons, or reintroduce Saturday morning school for the fifth form. I don't have a fifth form to teach. It may occur to me, I hope it would, to ask other people's advice, so that my thoughts are not prompted only by things that I happen to remember or think of. Now, when I eventually produce my solution, it will be judged as rational or not according to whether it stands up to analysis. It is, if it is judged as rational, then people will say that I am a rational thinker, or that my thinking was rational. But that will not be a comment on the series of thoughts, images, words, moments of despair that happen to pass through my mind. It will be a comment on the outcome of that process. My contention, to sum up those 3 problems, is that all rational thinking of any type is just like any other conscious activity. A sequence of thoughts that prompt each other, with the sequence determined by the existing personality and experience of the thinker, and any input from the senses or particularly from other people. A small amount of thinking may be fairly systematic, but only in simple one right answer tasks, where each step in the method leads by memory association to the next. But most consists of ideas or memories just occurring to the thinker. Now, have I just done that one? Have I just changed it? Right. That last phrase might suggest that our thinking is not deliberate, but in a sense out of our control. Quite right. Think about a memory. It's either triggered by the situation, or it isn't. Whether it is triggered depends partly on the situation itself, e.g. the question that's posed, but even more on the past history of the person concerned. You cannot deliberately remember something, in the sense of deliberately bringing it to mind at a particular moment. If it's already in your mind, and if you happen to have a desire to keep it there, and if there's nothing to distract you, then you can keep remembering it for a time. Similarly, you cannot avoid remembering something if the memory is triggered. When I was about 7, my father told me that if I went down to the kitchen at 3 a.m. in the morning, I would find there, on the table, all for me to spend as I please, £1,000,000. Just so long as I didn't think about crocodiles. I got the point immediately, even at 7, precocious kid. And I've spent the last 60 years nearly trying to think of some way around it. Like getting so old that I really do forget what it is I'm not allowed to think about. Not there yet. The point is that what comes into our minds is triggered by a combination of what is in there already and stimuli from outside. This is not some wacky point, but sheer logic. You can't decide to think about something unless you are already thinking about it. We are at the mercy of what occurs to us. Now, not only is thinking, even rational thinking, not something we deliberately do, it's often not even done consciously. We're sometimes told, I think we have been told in fact, that animals cannot reason because they do not have language, which implies an assumption that language and reasoning go hand in hand. Well, let's see if that stands up. What happens when we talk? Now, most of us, unless we're drunk or asleep or mad, talk rationally, in the sense that what we say makes sense, it's understood by the speaker, it conveys what we mean, and it's understood by the listener. At least some of the things we say are intelligent, thoughtful, and logical. But an occasion like this, where I'm saying words that I've already spent several months thinking up, is quite exceptional. In the vast majority of cases where people talk, as in the question session coming soon, or over lunch, or over breakfast, we talk impromptu. That means that although we know roughly what point we want to make or what impression to convey, the words just come out unplanned. Tumble out was a word I heard used yesterday. Put it down there, yes. Now, we don't know the end of a sentence we've started. We don't know how many clauses it will have, and so on. Now, sometimes that can get us into trouble, and we lose our way. But generally, we produce a perfectly grammatical and syntactically coherent sentence or paragraph with no planning. Now, no doubt something is going on neurologically, which we may one day discover, maybe have, already, I don't know. But one thing that is not going on is a conscious, deliberate decision to say this word or phrase, and then this one, and then that one, etc. We may be speaking consciously and deliberately, but the selection of this sequence of words rather than that is not accompanied by a conscious, deliberate act of choosing. It just happens automatically, a product of our past history and the requirements of the moment. Like walking, we just do it because we know how to, without thinking. Every now and again, we adjust our movement to avoid a pothole in the pavement. Just as we avoid saying a word we realize we were about to say when we remember that it might offend the listener. At those moments, we are conscious of what we're about to do and deliberately adapt. But in between, we walk and talk almost effortlessly and for the most part, perfectly rationally. To conclude, first of all, much of our thinking is in the form of gut reactions. System one. And it's very often perfectly adequate. But we are prone to all kinds of cognitive bias, even when we think we're being intelligent and rational. And secondly, even when we are being as rational as we can be, the rational solutions we come up with are either triggered automatically by remembered cues, e.g. 7 plus 5 equals 12, whether we like it or not, a kind of Pavlovian system of stimulus and response, occurring only in the most basic calculations and achievable by the least intellectual of people, and by parrots, or they occur to us in a variety of non-systematic ways, a kind of thought association, each thought triggered by the previous thought in a way that is determined by our experience, gets determined by our experience, our memories, our mood, in particular the people we are talking or working with. So, my contention, I've missed something out, I've just said all that. My contention is that the phrase rational thinking is a transferred epithet. Rational properly applies not to the anarchic constituents of our conscious minds, the images, the imagined words, the extraneous interruptions, but to the outcome. The thinking itself is not done in some inferentially connected sequence. It consists of just one damn thought after another. Thoughts, like everything else in the world, just happen.
I'm not quite sure how the process, I mean, you described what proper thought of as conjecture and refutation, but I can't see why the refutation part of it, the submission of what you've randomly or associatively thought, why that process of analysis and determination is rational is not a piece of rational thinking.
Right. I had a paragraph on that, and I realised it would carry it over the limits. I thought someone could have asked that, so I'll erase that paragraph.
Good.
Well, I think rather like any other thinking, if, for instance, someone tells me that the anagram of what was unscrewed was, say, I don't know, cruiser. That's a bit silly, but I might think, oh, cruiser. Now, it would then occur to me, I mean, whether I like it or not, is going to occur to me to check those letters up against the anagram. I mean, I'm bound to think that. If I don't think it, clearly I'm not being rational, but I'm bound to think that. And so, and therefore, I am bound to think, let's take the word cruiser. C, yes, that's there. R, yes, that's there. U, yes, that's there. I, damn. And then, that's really just one thought after another, which, I mean, I could predict I would have had. I've taken a fairly basic thought. So I would say that the same thing goes on when you're checking as when you're thinking up the answer in the first place. Yeah, look at this.
This is what occurred to me while you were speaking, so I haven't really thought through the implications of this. You were saying that rationality is a judgment on the outcome of a process. But there are situations in life where we have to judge people's capacity for more, if you like, rational thought or reasoning, and that's not how it's judged. So under the Mental Capacity Act, people are judged as whether they can go through a process, whether they're capable of remembering things, whether they're capable of understanding questions put to them, whether they're capable of, in some sense, weighing up information. But a person who's legally judged to have mental capacity, i.e. in some sense to make informed decisions, is allowed to make what might be thought to be unwise decisions. So when we make these judgments about people as to whether they can make decisions regarding their welfare. We're making some judgments about whether they can go through a process, even though the outcome of that process we may think in some sense is irrational. I just wondered whether you have had any comments on that.
If I understand you correctly, if this is somebody we're not sure about, we test to see. I mean, the test presumably will be by asking them questions.
Yes.
And we judge their mind on the answers they come up with.
Well, not necessarily whether they come up with the right answer.
No, but something.
It's the processes that they've been through in terms of talking
about it. I mean, if I ask somebody to remember when the Battle of Hastings was, and they say, blue.
Mm. Yeah,
that could be an indication, yeah. I mean, it's difficult to know how you could test anybody's rationality except by the outcome of what they told you. See what I mean? I'm not quite sure how you could test in any other way. Not necessarily get the answer right, but I mean, if you said when was the Battle of Hastings, and they said 1415, well, that just tells you they don't know something. But if they say blue, that tells you they're not really on the same level. You see what I mean? I'm not sure how you would know someone as irrational or rational except by the answers they produce to questions.
So you're both right. I'm asking.
Well, I'm not quite sure in what. Are we disputing anything here?
Well, I don't know. I was thinking in life we should. I mean, some people make a decision that some people think is irrational to refuse life-saving medical treatment.
Yes.
But they are considered to be somebody who's not cognitively impaired.
No, I suppose in a sense, I'm using the word rational in two slightly different senses. If we might say that someone's decision not to seek life-saving treatment, I might think it's not rational, because in other words it's wrong. But I might nevertheless think the person was rational, and perhaps in the sense that I was talking about speaking, we all talk rationally. In that sense of rational, in other words, capable of thinking making decisions that are completely stupid.
I suppose I'm just questioning whether we can judge rationality just on outcomes.
Well, I think regardless of that, I think yes, because the only way we would judge it is on outcome. I think if somebody did refuse, say, to let their child have a life-saving operation, You wouldn't know, in effect, whether they were just mad or whether they were thinking in a way which we didn't agree with. So you'd have to ask them some other questions. And if you said to them, when was the Battle of Hastings? They said, blue. Then you would know that they weren't being rational in any sense at all. Well, a few other questions as well.
Oh, yes. I think you may have overstated your case, Paul, in that although it's possibly clear that rationality is more often and better applied to analysis, post-rationalisation and judgment, or justification even more so, than to the actual first expression of the argument. Nevertheless, there is a constant feedback going on as you are making the argument. You have that possible justification analysis hanging over you as a kind of judge while you're giving the testimony. And take, for example, and method is the key here. Rationality is a method. It's a method that you can choose rather than certain other methods like poetry. For example, in your anagram example, both examples, it is entirely rational to choose a subassembly first, like and then proceed from there, or to proceed via subassemblies, rather than trying to assemble all seven letters at once. Equally with the composer, and I still haven't sold that one, I probably never will. First thing I'd say is, how many composers are there with the letter K in their names? Because that's a rare letter. But both of those are rational methods. And when you said method is just a memory, it's not. Memory is a method is an ability. And we have a number of these abilities, each of which is a kind of subassembly of rationality. ways of going about things. So I think the key lies actually in, for example, statistical example. I was trying to divide a million by 100, and my method of doing that is to visualize a million and cut two noughts from it. Now, I'm sure a lot of other people will do it in a quite different way, but it is a rational method of going about that particular problem. It's a memory, but a method.
It's rational, yes. I mean, it may be the wrong method. You can go through a perfectly systematic method, as I did, and come to 99%, which is wrong. That seemed to me at the time rational and so on, but it was wrong. So the method which you have, which is to divide 100 into a million, for a start, you have to be aware that that's the way to do it, and that's a memory.
That's another memory, but it's a method.
As I said, you can remember methods.
Yes, method is more than a memory. It's a continuing ability.
But you still got to remember it. I'm not denying it's a method, but you only use a method if you remember to use the method.
And it's like bicycle. But you don't remember how to ride a bicycle.
No, but it may be the memory is unconscious, I would have thought of it. But if you're asked, for instance, that particular question, if ever anyone asks me that sort of question again, I'm going to remember that you divide a million by 100. I didn't know that when Peter Milligan said it, so I didn't do that. Though you know the method because you've at some point learnt it and you now remember it. Even if you don't think to yourself, the method I'm going to use is that. It may just come. Someone says to me 7 times 15. I suppose I didn't sort of think I can do 7 tenths and 7 fifths. Yes, I think maybe you don't necessarily remember the method consciously, you just remember it unconsciously. You've still got to remember it, I would say.
Yes, you remember how to be rational.
Because, you remember the... But it is, as I say, just consists, rationality just consists of remembering, in that case.
I'm not going to argue.
We have 1 minute left, and Mike is the next question.
Thank you. Unlike others, I would like to express 100% agreement with what you said. In fact, insofar as we are not rational, I will express 200% agreement with you. But I would like to strengthen something you actually said. I think you undersell your theories, because even basic arithmetical operations are subject to biases. I remember seeing some research in which it was demonstrated that if you give people, before subjecting to a very simple arithmetical test, a questionnaire which includes this question of their gender, just remind them of their gender, that women do significantly worse than men. Without the question, they don't.
Even
basic arithmetic is affected by subliminal cues like that.
That sounds absolutely extraordinary. No one would believe that if it hadn't actually been tested. I've never seen that. It does. We can test it on the audience.
Thank you very much.